U.S. Lens. I'm Ron Insana, Senior Advisor for Schroders North America. As you well know, emerging markets have been in some ways challenged, just as developed markets around the world have been of late, whether it's a zero COVID policy in China that has constrained growth, or whether it's been a strengthening U.S. dollar that's made investing for Americans overseas a little more difficult. There have been a wide variety of concerns in the emerging market world. But joining us now to talk about what could be some emerging opportunities in that arena is Tom Wilson. He is head of emerging market equities for Schroders. Tom, thanks for being with us. Good to have you back today.
It's great to be on, Ron. Thanks very much for having me.
Let's start with big picture emerging market before we get down into maybe some of the more individualized situations that we see around the world. Just when you look across the broad spectrum of EM right now, how would you characterize the state of play?
Okay, so there have been different drivers. First up, you've had dollar strength.
It's got another big theme, obviously, is the strong dollar, up nearly 17% this year alone.
I think the reality is there's still two drivers keeping the dollar strength in the near term. First of all, the Fed staying hawkish. The second point, more importantly, is the risk aversion. If markets and investors are expecting the U.S. economy to go into a recession sometime in 2023, that risk aversion is likely to keep the dollar well supported.
So basically, a strong dollar is a headwind for emerging financial conditions. So it tightens financial conditions, it's a headwind for dollar nominal growth, and thereby it's also a headwind for equity market performance. Next up, you've had inflation.
Yeah, look, I mean, inflation is something that everyone thinks affects them.
My concern about inflation is the drivers. Question is now, how long do we have to live with inflation?
And emerging markets are less developed than developed market counterparts, and therefore food and fuel are bigger in the CPI basket, and we've seen issues on both of those fronts. So therefore, inflation's also risen to relatively elevated levels, in certain cases more driven by external factors than domestic. And that has led emerging market central banks to have to tighten monetary policy.
Asian officials are stepping up rhetoric and defense as their currency on their currencies as they continue to sit humble while the US dollar charges ahead.
When they see U.S. interest rates going up, in particular, they see that the storm is coming, so they prepare themselves, and that meant that they hiked interest rates sooner than others.
That obviously in addition to pressure on the currencies from a strong dollar, and that's a headwind for growth. Next up, you've got concerns about the direction of global growth.
All right, we're getting you up to speed on global growth. The worst is yet to come, and for many, 2023 will feel like a recession.
The 2023 slowdown will be broad-based, with countries accounting for a third of the global economy expected to contract this year or next. The three largest economies, the United States, China, and the euro area, will continue to stall.
So you've got a marked slowdown coming, already here in certain circumstances, and a lot of EM is cyclical and trade orientated. And so there's been a substantial revision in expectations, certainly for next year and also partly for this year as well. So you've seen a series of different significant headwinds face emerging, and that's why the market's off, getting on for 30%. On a year-to-date basis.
And that's pretty much been a global phenomenon, both for developed and emerging markets. It's not as if there's a wide disparity between performance. So when you look across the spectrum of emerging markets, and you have obviously one that's dominant like China and also undergone some tumult, is there a way to, at this juncture, differentiate, or is this really at this point anyway, still a macro play?
I mean, it's very heavily a macro play. Effectively, everything is a macro play right now, given inflation and monetary policy and the implications for growth broadly. Now, within emerging, there are, however, ways to differentiate. So part of emerging is much more commodity-led. And within that, you get some countries which are more energy-led, other countries that might be more sort of metals-led. Other elements of emerging are much more trade-led. They've been under quite substantial pressure. Other areas of emerging are a bit more economically insular, a bit more domestically led. It's one of the reasons, for example, why India's performed relatively well on a year-to-date basis. And generally, markets are in a different position in terms of policy orthodoxy, policy credibility, the extent to which central banks might have moved, and thereby some countries are ahead in the monetary cycle. So basically, emerging is a diverse place. And that's why active investors like us have the opportunity to generate alpha, because we can take advantage of that.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
So let me ask you about then the elephant in the room, China, which has obviously had influence to a certain extent over the macro of late with zero COVID policy, with geopolitical and internal political changes here. How do you characterize the environment there?
Yeah, I mean, China is a big market within emerging. It's about 30% of the benchmark. And so what happens there matters for emerging in general. Where to begin? So let's start with near-term economics. So last year, China had two big drags. One was a negative credit impulse, and the other was broad-based regulatory action.
How do you think about an investment where, in the stroke of a pen, China could come and change the rules of the game?
I think that you have to be careful about areas that are going to be heavily regulated. So areas where there is a lot of consumer data, where there's national security interests.
The crackdown is about control. And actually, directionally, you can understand. They were abusing people's data. They were running monopolies. They were not compliant with a lot of regulations.
But when you come in and say that this business can no longer make money, and you basically crack down as they have done, this is a part of a long series of crackdowns, it sends a very worrying sign for private business, and frankly, any sort of business in China.
And they were both growth headwinds. But we expected Chinese growth to improve this year, and that's because the credit impulse pivoted to positive at the back end of last year, the beginning of this year. And typically that leads growth by about 9 months. We were expecting the Chinese government to want a more benign growth environment as they went into the party congress that we've just had in October. So what happened? What happened was zero COVID policy got in the way.
Now, China's escalating COVID-19 resurgence has spurred the authorities there to mount up the measures to contain the outbreaks.
As we all know, they will reframe the term zero COVID policy unchanged. That's no question to ask.
That was a risk at the beginning of the year. It became the base case given the more infectious Omicron variant of COVID. And China initially controlled COVID really very effectively, but it found it increasingly difficult to do so in the face of, as I said, a more infectious variant. So zero COVID policy has come through as a significant impact on activity and on consumption, especially services within consumption, which then has implications for the labor market. And also, it's impeded transmission of policy support. The zero COVID policy, in conclusion, has been really quite growth negative. Then you've had the party congress, which, you know, the market has reacted relatively negatively to. And there were several key things that happened there. Firstly, President Xi was confirmed for a third term.
Xi Jinping has become the most powerful leader in China in decades after being given a third term as leader of the Communist Party. Unless he's forcibly removed from power, Mr. Xi should now be able to personally choose for how long he will govern.
China is embarking on a long journey filled with glory and dreams, and the bugle has been sounded.
And in addition to that, the Standing Committee and Politburo appointees were all Xi loyalists. So the market, or various people in the market, would see this as the culmination of his consolidation of power. Secondly, there was, in effect, a reiteration of policy intent. So you had policy continuity, and the market generally has disliked the recent direction of government policy. And then finally, there was, in addition to that, a stated commitment to stick with zero COVID policy for the time being. And again, that brings with it, you know, significant issues vis-a-vis growth and fiscal and policy transmission and so on. So bring that together, what does it all mean? Well, on a structural basis, markets are concerned that President Xi's consolidation of power may be a negative for policy debate, and that could carry economic and geopolitical consequences. Secondly, as already mentioned, markets dislike the direction of government economic policy. In certain cases, government policy does have positive impacts. You know, they're looking for higher quality growth. They're looking for growth that comes at less of a cost to inequality. But markets are concerned about higher levels of state intervention in the economy. And that really derives from, you know, what the market would see as broad-based and really quite heavy-handed regulatory action last year. And then finally, clearly, you know, the market would prefer that China explicitly sought some exit route from zero COVID policy, which would remove the risk of recurrent restrictions. So where we sit now is that growth is weak. The party Congress raised in the market's eyes some issues which, you know, potential structural negatives. And therefore, there's been quite a lot to worry about. But then we've got to pivot and we've got to think about what could go right, because the market risk premium has lifted in sort of recent months to a higher level to take account of these risks.
So, Tom, with respect to zero COVID policy, we've gotten over the last few days some conflicting reports. Do you know where we stand with respect to that right now?
Yeah. Okay. So what really matters here is whether the Chinese can unwind zero COVID policy or not. And there are two things to really think about. Number one is vaccines. And number two is whether the domestic media narrative shifts. So firstly, on vaccines, we've seen news flow recently on both an mRNA vaccine and on a nasal vaccine. And both look to be more effective than existing vaccines, for example, Sinovac. But in addition, the nasal vaccine looks to carry much lower risk of side effects. Now, this means that you might be able to see the vaccine penetration rate, especially for the elderly, lift. And in effect, that might enable the Chinese authorities to begin to pivot more meaningfully away from existing zero COVID constraints. Then you've got the domestic media narrative, and that has firmly orientated towards, we, the government, have protected you from the fatalities and the significant health impact seen in, for example, Western countries. So we've done a good job. Now, if you begin to see that pivot somewhat, i.e. the media narrative pivots to, we now have homegrown vaccines which are highly effective and carry low risk of side effects, so go and get them. And at the same time, we have a virus which is perhaps more infectious, but much less lethal or dangerous than it was. In combination, that might lead people to believe that the government is increasingly going to pivot away from the existing zero COVID policy. And the markets would take that very well.
Are there any emergent tailwinds beyond reducing zero COVID policies that China might enjoy this coming year?
I mean, obviously, you do still get the lagged impact of policy stimulus. So typically, any policy stimulus shows up with about a 9-month lag, give or take. So that will continue to feed through. But really, zero COVID policy is an impediment to policy transmission. And so, again, this is why it's so important that there's an ongoing pivot away from it as we go through time. Because otherwise, there still are some further headwinds to face. So, I mean, certainly on the real estate side.
The property market is in pretty serious trouble. Housing specifically took a real gut punch. Sales are down. Prices are down. Not just compared to earlier this year, but compared to last year.
You already have quite a low base as a function of stress already seen, but we're not expecting a marked uplift in real estate as we go through the next 12 months. So, you know, you might see some improvement, but pretty marginal on that front. And then you get the trade side.
Investors have turned cautious after the disappointing release of China's manufacturing and non-manufacturing PMI, both unexpectedly contracted in October, pointing to more economic headwinds ahead. This as China continues to grapple with COVID-19 lockdowns.
And on the trade front, China will be facing the same cyclical headwinds that other emerging trade-orientated economies are facing. But in addition to that, it also actually took market share during COVID, because initially zero COVID policy worked very well. So there are some estimates it took as much as 5 percentage points of trade share during COVID. And I would think it would be now relinquishing that, given that generally other competing manufacturing economies have normalized. So you see maybe limited uplift in real estate and probably quite a headwind on the trade side as you go through the next 12 months.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about the rest of the world. You mentioned that India has done well. We've seen some emerging markets that not everyone really loves to touch, like Turkey, do well in certainly in local currency terms to an extent. Are there places around the world that are beginning to normalize in a meaningful way, even with the strength of the dollar and concerns about a global recession?
Yeah, there are. I mean, there are some markets which are looking increasingly interesting now valuation-wise. So typically what happens in a major down cycle is that earnings revisions lag, valuations run ahead. And so you've seen substantial reset in markets like Korea, for example. I'd say you're well through the reset in Taiwanese tech. So cyclical gem has been resetting from a valuation multiple perspective. And now you've got earnings revisions which have kicked in. But in certain cases, you can find stocks which have derated down towards trough valuations, and that gives you a significant margin of safety. So you can say, you know what, it's cheap enough. I can ignore near-term volatility. I could ignore the risk of some further negative EPS revisions because I'm expecting at some point in time to get beyond this current cyclical stress. And at that point, I'm going to make money on the earnings rebound. I'm going to make money on the multiple rebound. And also in certain cases, I'm probably going to make money on currency recovery as well.
Do you then look at individual stocks overseas with respect to an active manager's work, or do you still look country by country, knowing that emerging markets, certainly at this juncture, are no longer monolithic?
No, I think both are relevant. I mean, from our perspective in emerging, understanding the macro is still critical. In terms of understanding how, say, politics impacts policy, you know, how that might impact a company's operating environment, how it could impact currency, how it could impact yield curve, and so on. So for emerging market investment, you really need to understand the macro environment in which stocks operate. But then obviously there are also idiosyncratic stock drivers, which you need to understand as well. So for emerging investment, it really is a combination of both.
Is there any way for emerging markets to escape the gravitational pull of the U.S., either on a stock-by-stock basis or on a country basis, if the U.S. were to go into recession next year, which, as you mentioned, yield curves, the U.S. yield curve is forecasting, for all intents and purposes, that the U.S. will get hit with a recession next year? How important is that a factor with respect to the emerging market outlook?
It really depends how much has been priced in, and also critical is what the dollar does. So what you have right now is you have concerns of recession, and markets always look ahead. So markets are pricing in a cyclical downturn, and that's why some of these cyclical companies have derated down towards trough valuation. So that's point one. Point two, okay, so right now in America, you have a degree of economic resilience relative to other countries. You've got a degree of economic momentum. You've got energy self-sufficiency. And all that is dollar supportive because of what the Fed's doing as a result. And then in addition to that, you've got safe haven flow, which I would say is an additional dollar support. So not only if you're an emerging company or country might you be hit by a revision in expectations on the cyclical side, but you're probably getting hit on your currency. You know, you're getting hit by that dollar strength. And so looking into next year, yes, you might be in the midst of you know, a worse economic environment in the States, maybe a recession, but you might have already priced it. And if the markets begin to believe that the Fed is re-anchoring inflation successfully and the Fed has policy credibility and Fed expectations have peaked, that's when the dollar could stabilize. And also people will be looking for economic troughs ex-US as well. And again, that could support a degree of dollar stabilization. And the dollar's expensive. It's a richly valued currency now. So then that's where you're going to make money. because you get the dollar stabilization, which alleviates pressure on EMFX. And if the dollar begins to roll over and ease, then EMFX can recover. That alleviates pressure on emerging market central banks. And as a dollar investor, you're going to begin to make money effectively on EMFX relative to dollar. And then, you know, arguably the cyclical downdraft will have been priced in. So then people are going to be looking beyond, looking to recovery. And again, markets preempt. And that's where you're going to make your money on the multiple lifting again, and hopefully earnings expectations improving as well from a low base.
Final question around the unpredictability of geopolitical events. We know what's going on in Ukraine. We have concerns about other parts of the world. Clearly, how much does geopolitical risk factor into your work as you comb through different companies and countries with respect to EM investments?
Yeah, I mean, both political and geopolitical risk are very relevant within the emerging space. It can either impact country or stock choice or sector exposure, or it can impact how much risk you might take in a particular area as a fund manager, i.e. how you manage risk. From a geopolitical standpoint, the key issue really is the rising tension between the US and China. So that's been obviously rising in recent years and is now leading to economic outcomes. So I think that is, for example, driving the supply chain diversification away from China that we're seeing. It's going to be driving a degree of economic decoupling generally as both sides push more towards a higher degree of economic self-sufficiency. And that is inefficient from a global economic perspective, and thereby really inflationary from a global economic perspective generally, I would say. However, you know, you can say, well, maybe it's going to be an impediment to China from a medium-term perspective. But supply chain diversification, you've also got to look at who the potential winners are. And within that framework, we think about the opportunity for different emerging markets, which might benefit from that trend. So Mexico could be a potential beneficiary, especially obviously given geographic proximity to the U.S. Other Asian countries like sort of Vietnam, which is not emerging its frontier at the moment, but you know, that's an economy which could benefit. Other areas of ASEAN, Korea could be a beneficiary. So you've got to think not just about the risks, but also about some of the opportunities that might derive from these trends.
All right, Tom, always a pleasure. Thanks for being with us today. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, anytime. Great to be on. Thank you, Ron.
Tom Wilson is the head of emerging market equities for Schroders, joining us in today's U.S. Lens. I'm Ron Insana. We'll talk to you again soon.
Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to find out more, check out our website, schroders.com/theinvestor download. You can also get in contact with us about anything in the show or ideas for future shows at schroderspodcast@schroders.com. Please remember to subscribe to us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review. We're now doing one show a week, which will be available every Thursday from 5 p.m. UK time. Thanks very much for listening, but above all, keep safe and go well. Cheers.
The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.